Standing tall, blue shorts, toned leg muscles, and a side satchel slung over the shoulder. Dogs bark as the sun glints off their sunglasses. Checking the letters for the address and name, hastily written so you can heroically open the mailbox and drop in. A postal employee doesn't really seem like the hero type, but in the late 1800s and early 1900s, they were the last line of defense from the burgeoning criminals scouring the United States. The postal inspector could go anywhere, investigate anything, and even supersede police and federal agents. This was the time of the superhero postal inspectors. They gave the phrase going postal a whole new meaning.
I didn't see you there.
It all started early this morning.
From hunting ghosts to Bigfoot, UFOs,
cryptids, true crime, paranormal, and more.
I've always wanted to see a UFO.
Oh, I was researching for your entertainment.
That's Bigfoot's get.
He basically wrote the book on modern culture.
We aren't really comedians.
What if Buddha did cocaine?
The Addams Family on meth.
This is the Black Cat Report. See you on the other side.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, night, and welcome to episode 88. I am Joey, and with me is Gilliam 3000. Not to be confused with Gilliam 2000, he's a more updated model. In this version, they gave them the ability to sleep.
I still haven't found that feature yet. Hello, everybody!
It's coming on the update, I think. That's what I heard. Well, today, we're going to delve into an awesome, true history story of a villainous group called the Black Hand Society and how they were brought down by a postal inspector named John Frank Oldfield, as well as a few other characters that we'll get into as well. The main reference for our story is an amazing and well-written book called Inspector Oldfield and the Black Hand Society by William Oldfield and Victoria Bruce, which is interesting because it's his great-grandson that actually helped write the book from old papers and stuff that they found in family keepsakes, which is really cool, I think.
Pretty awesome.
Well, this story is going to take us through the last decade of the 1800s and the early 1900s, and the lives of two different sorts of lawmen of their kind, as well as the beginnings of the Italian, or actually the Sicilian, mafia in the United States. This will be at least a two-part series on this, and as I found the book infinitely fascinating and the subject matter amazing. First off, we're going to get into the stories of our protagonists. Born on January 2nd, 1867, John Frank Oldfield in Ellicott City, Maryland, which he was like to be noted as being called Frank. He just went by his middle name, you know. He was one out of 11 kids.
God damn.
And was the smallest, of his five brothers. So he had five brothers, five sisters.
He was the runt of the litter.
He was the runt. Yeah. Even though he was small compared to his brothers, he loved to fight. Usually kind of how it happens, because this probably because he had to learn how to fight, being smaller than the other boys his age, and he had to get real tenacious. Well, the Oldfield family was actually a very rich one and gained notoriety for helping in the early development of the Republican Party in Maryland. So, Frank's father was noted as a fervent supporter of Abraham Lincoln, which allowed him to have a lot of favors that will be repaid to him later on. Well, all of the Oldfield sons ended up working at the Hamilton Oldfield Iron and Pump Works. So, his dad and a family friend both went in together on this iron and pump works and were just like, hey, let's just get all of our family to work for us. So, it made it kind of easier and a little cheaper.
That free family labor.
Yep. Frank wasn't much for living the manual labor kind of life, and he really didn't like that work. He also hated paperwork. So I guess he wouldn't have liked to live nowadays, because I feel like it's either all manual labor job or computer work. There's like no in between anymore.
You mean to tell me he didn't like working at an iron factory in the 1800s? What's wrong with this guy?
Right? Yeah.
So weird.
I think he just, I know, he was, even though he liked to fight, which was like, he was still physical, you know, like he didn't like the manual labor part.
I told you, I like to fight humans, not elements, goddammit. But like, can you imagine how shitty the pay had to have been? So like, you know, 1800s, America, iron factory, iron production, stuff like that. Not exactly known for workers' rights at that time. So could you imagine working for family on top of that?
Yeah, he's just like, get back out there. 16 hours ain't enough. I was working 20 hours when I was your age.
You still owe me 16 hours or else you'll be more in debt. God damn it. What?
Dad, there's only 24 hours a day and I've been working 16 hours. Don't
Who
matter.
Who the fuck asked you to math?
Yeah, you don't get paid to do math here. Well, anyways, around 1888, when Frank was about 21 years old, his dad was appointed to be postmaster of Ellicott City in Maryland. It was a favor from the Republican Party that he got, so he kind of used that because he was a big supporter of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, he was in the good old boys club.
Well, now I know what you're saying. Oh, he's just a little postmaster. What's the big deal, right? Back then, this was a hugely coveted job because the pay was amazing, first off. They were making what would probably be like $80,000 to $90,000, $100,000 a year.
Yeah,
which is
damn.
Pretty good in our time period, yeah. Comparatively. I think it was like $2,000 to $3,000 a year, which is like awesome when the normal pay was like $600 a year.
And just like and like part of, and this is like the notorious part of like, you know, the postman like history, but you know, you basically wake up in the morning and you just get poon after poon after poon until you can't walk anymore. You were just impregnating the countryside as a postman.
Yeah. And what's really cool is it's literally a work from home job, which is kind of funny.
Oh,
part of it was. So they get to actually set up the post office, the postal service office, mm-hmm. wherever they wanted. And a lot of them would just put it up in their house.
Yeah, it's in the laundry room.
So they just, they just start there and they're like, cool, I can just work here and just walk there or walk, you know, walk downstairs and they're there. So it was kind of a cool, like posting, you know, and as everyone nowadays wants that work from home.
It's like Uber for envelopes.
Yeah. Well, I like to say it was also a great job because like all the medicines that were sent, all the mm-hmm. newspapers.
You got to try them first.
That's true. Everything traveled through the postal service, right? Uh-huh. There wasn't a phone to check. There wasn't computers or anything to just open up and be like, I have the news. Or like Uber, you couldn't get anywhere super quick. It was just like everything was down to a community level. And the only way it got spread out was through the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah.
And there's a huge, in this book, there's a huge, probably about 35 pages of the beginning of the Postal Service and how it was against a man named William Goddard. And as most people know, Benjamin Franklin, were, you know, the creator of the U.S. Postal Service. In this, they make that William Goddard was the actual beginner of it, and Benjamin Franklin just came in and was like, I did it. He kind of just took claim for it.
You see what I did to that kite, didn't ya? Be a real shame if that happened to your kids.
Real shame if you were the key on the kite. Well, he took claim for it, and then once the Congress was like, hey, we're going to vote in the first U.S. postmaster, they decided Benjamin Franklin, and then Benjamin Franklin made his second in command his son, and William Goddard was super pissed. There's a whole chapter about this guy being so pissed that he did not get the job that he started because he was the one that went around all of the colonies and was like finding the paper or finding the roads to go to, hiring the people himself to take stuff.
He actually did the work.
He actually did the work. He could have been caught and thrown in jail or hung for being a traitor because this was when the English Postal Service were basically like trying to keep the U.S. from spreading gossip, spreading rumors, spreading stuff like that about how the king sucks and we're not getting taxed and stuff like that.
You're trying to clamp down on dissent. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is, but that to like go back to your point about like how important this was at the time,
mm-hmm.
it's literally an act of Congress.
Yep.
First one was literally an act of Congress to announce the first, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty big deal.
Yeah, and it's still important now. Mm-hmm. Like the U.S. Postal Service is still important because think if FedEx or UPS, mm-hmm. you know, ran stuff, think how expensive it is comparatively to send a box through UPS or FedEx comparative if you go to the U.S. Postal Service, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing to have that, you know? So I thank you all the postal people. You guys are amazing. We appreciate you.
Yeah, for real. We wouldn't have books for any episodes if it wasn't for y'all. Thank you.
That's true. Well, Frank was obsessively clean as a kid and an adult, for the time anyways, brushed his teeth zealously, and we went to the barber every week, and he dressed in a suit and tie, looking like a Wall Street baron of the time, right? And like, he wasn't even, you know, he was still going out and doing stuff and, you know, having to go find postal people to work and doing all this stuff, but he still looked like he was like super rich, which his family was pretty rich at this time and they had a lot of favors. But he showered too, which was weird because it's like the 1800s. They didn't shower a whole lot comparatively to the way they do now.
So he looked like his wealth.
Yes, exactly. He looked like he was. He's not like the rich people of today wearing like, I don't know, something a person that didn't have any clothes was wearing on the street, which is like they try to look poor, you know? It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Well, Frank Oldfield was a fair man and he believed in the rule of law, which would come in handy in his later years, of course, as the story unfolds. A particular incident kind of shoved him in the direction that he would go in his later years. On February of 1895, the owner of Shea's General Store on Main Street, Daniel Shea, was found murdered. His head was bashed in with like a steel pipe.
Damn.
And there was a trail of blood. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. They eventually tracked down who they thought was the murderer, which, you know, former slave named Jacob Henson.
Oh, I thought it was going to be old Greg.
So, sadly not.
I fell on some pipes.
I fell on some pipes and there's blood everywhere. Well, he was still covered in the shopkeeper's blood. And that's what they said, right? When the police caught him. It doesn't go into the whole history of whether he was not guilty or not, you know, in real life. But he was a former slave. The shopkeeper was very loved in the town.
They shot him 15 times and then they were like, look, there's blood on him. And he's like, God damn it, you did that.
Yeah, he did that. That could also have been a possibility. Well, Henson originally said in his confession, because as soon as they came to him, he confessed that he had just come back from the tavern to speak with his boss.
I was at
his
the boss cherry was festival. Daniels.
These are just cherry juice.
God damn it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was Maryland, so cherry blossoms, but...
Trick.
Well, he came back to speak with his boss. His boss was the murdered person, Daniel Shea. And they got into an argument, and the shopkeeper attacked him. So Henson reacted in self-defense. And Henson was noted as being like a really built, younger, big guy. And Daniel Shea, the shopkeeper, was a lot older, probably 50s, 60s. And so obviously he wasn't going to be able to beat Henson up. So Henson beat him with the lead pipe. That's what the story was. Well, Henson was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to death. Well, here's where Frank Oldfield comes back into it. Frank did not agree with capital punishment or even, you know, the decree at all. So he just didn't like the idea of capital punishment. Well, didn't want anybody killed from the government. He was like, basically, if you're gonna do anything, just put him in jail for life. You know, put him away. At least I'll be able, you know, he'll be able to be alive, visit with family if they're there, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But since he's a stickler for the law, he wouldn't fight the court's decision, right? He was like, that's the decision. That's what the court's going to do.
Yeah.
Well, since this was just after the Civil War, and there was still a lot of racism going on, even in the North, because we're in Maryland, a few people from the Southern Democrat Party started whisperings of lynching Henson. Yeah. Even with the guilty verdict, they still wanted to celebrate their own kind of vigilante justice. Well, Frank was like, no, this ain't happening. So
you got to stand
like,
for that.
He's going to. Yeah. He's like, you're going to be hung by the federal, you know, federal system. He's going to be hung by the state. He's not going to be killed and lynched by a big mob of people.
Look, guys, we're trying to institutionalize racism now. You can't just be doing it on your own anymore.
Yeah, you can't do it on your end, which is crazy because this fucking happened a lot. And I don't know. This happened way more than people talk about. It's funny to say that.
Lynch
just
mobs.
Before even.
A total thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because he was like, look, this is that he needs to be hung by the state. He convinced his brother, right? So he convinced his brother to sit in the jail, like in the jailhouse around it with two pistols and just protect him. Right. Mm-hmm. And they're like, if a mob comes, we're going to shoot him. And his brother, Clarence, they sat there and they just waited. They're just like, okay, somebody's going to try to break in here basically because they wanted to hang him.
You know how confused the guy who's like in the cell, the one who's being charged with murder has to be, is just like, wait, so y'all are going to kill me, but those folks who want to kill me, you're protecting me by threatening to kill them. They try to kill me. before y'all kill me. Like,
yeah.
Can I just go? Like, what's happening?
Yeah, he's like, yeah, it's so stupid. You know, he's like, I'm either going to die by you or I'm going to die by them.
And you're willing to kill other people so that you can kill me.
Yeah, it makes no sense, honestly. But since he was a stickler for the law, he wanted to, you know, kind of do what he wanted to do. So on the night of March 28th, 1985, Frank and two of his brothers stood guard, sitting in the freezing cold, pistols in hand, prepared for any mobs of people to come.
I knew I should have dried my hands off after I peed. This thing's been stuck on my hand for an hour.
You can't get the... It's my pistol.
Damn it.
Well, nobody came. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So Frank and his brothers did this for more than a week. They stayed in the freezing cold and waited again, but nobody came.
They probably could have made like a fire or something. I mean, eventually, you know, maybe had some like soup or... some coffee. I mean, they could have made it a little more homely than that.
Probably. But they didn't.
Sorry, I'm just thinking backwards here. They, just like,
yeah, yeah,
you know.
They didn't.
But they didn't. Swear to God, I'm going to kill anybody that tries to kill this person before we kill them.
Well, remember, their guns were stuck to their hands.
That's true.
Yeah, their guns were stuck to their hands, so they couldn't do anything with them.
It's like a built-in fire starter, though.
That's true. So Henson seems safe, right? So they're like, He's good.
Henson seems safe.
It was getting time for Henson to be hanged.
Yeah.
Right? He was safe to be hanged. So Frank and his brothers decided to pack it up and go home. They're like, okay, we're good. I think it's 2 days until he's going to be hanged. No big deal. We saved him to be hanged. So
we did it, you guys. We saved him.
Yeah, we saved him to be murdered. Well, sadly, the first night after Frank had left, a group of 27 men wearing hoods and handkerchiefs covering their face broke into the jail, dragged Henson out. They took him down the road to a tree and hung him.
God damn it. And they're like, if we really want to go meta here, technically those laws are supposed to represent the will of the people anyway.
You meted it for sure.
This is just so fucked on so many levels. Also, I can't get over, like, it's just been popping up in my head, but Master Killer's line in The Mysteries of Chess Boxing from Wu-Tang. Homicide's illegal and death is the penalty. What justifies the homicide when he dies? Such a fucking good line.
Yeah, that's
man.
A great line. Damn.
I had to go on in the tangent there.
No, I love it. Well, what's going to justify him is Frank's fucking pissed. That's what's justifying him. It's moving Frank's story on, which is very sad. Well, not only had the law been intervened with, but they had waited until he was out of the picture to kill this person, who in all possibility could have been innocent, because Frank in his story is kind of like, some of this stuff seems very cloudy. Some of this evidence seems very cloudy. And he mentioned it too in letters, like being like, I don't know if this guy is actually guilty.
The young black man who was described as being incredibly large and known for being buff and da 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 da, and this and the other. You know, the probably like elderly shop owner who, I'm just gonna go out on a limb here and say, probably was acting like a racist asshole and talking down to this person and treating them like shit.
Mm-hmm.
Not to judge too much, not just like gonna put that on him, but you know, you should know better when you're in the physically weaker of the two situation with anybody in life.
Yeah.
You don't just keep heating up the situation. And if you do, you probably got a fucking complex.
Yeah.
Put it out there.
Well, coming from my side of it, I don't even know if that guy killed him.
It was probably the white lady that was causing everybody else to get fucking hung because they, you know, said hello to her. She was a serial killer.
Yeah, you know, we got to kind of gloss over it, which is really sad, but this is a part that brings Frank into this next part of his life, which is like, Frank decided that he had to do something, and he, a man for the law, wanted to try and be able to influence things on a local level first.
I'm going to kill everyone first.
Yeah, he would get his chance. On July 2nd, 1896, the sheriff, Greenberry Johnson, fell off a trolley car on the way back from the Baltimore Orioles game and fractured his skull and died. I like how we're laughing at this, but it's just funny.
He was shit-faced. He was wasted.
Yeah, he just came home from an Orioles game. America's pastime.
These goddamn trolley car murders are just going So Frank Oldfield was the only one that could step up and save the trolley car until its execution day.
Yeah, yes. He stood around the trolley car as everybody went in to burn it heroically with his AK-47. Wouldn't have been a deal. The shotguns. Well, this was perfect timing for Frank, obviously. So he did what he always did. He petitioned his father.
You'll be really cool.
Who went to the governor of Maryland and got him the nomination and the job sheriff. Even with literally no experience in law enforcement, he got the job.
Dad.
This is a running theme of the whole story, that he just goes after his dad to get what he wants.
Just nepotism in the good old boys club.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Well, the job came with no training. And even today, the job doesn't come with training. You have to
sheriff?
Actually...
That yeah, explains a lot.
You get voted as a sheriff. But you do within... It's like a good faith measure. There's some like good faith law. Because I looked into this. There's a good faith law that you have to go within the year of being a sheriff to go get some kind of law enforcement training. But you literally don't have to be you don't have to be in law enforcement. You don't have to be anything since it's a it's a voting job, you know?
Yeah, this explains so much.
Yeah, I think that's crazy. Well, in Ellicott City, it was not known as a major crime hub, right?
But it was about to be.
But it was about to be.
Yeah.
Small town, and his duties were light, and he didn't really have that much to do.
Mm-hmm.
So his favorite brother, Clarence... He named him his bailiff. So him and his brother, you know, obviously a little nepotism going on. And him and his brother are now in charge. We're going to get into some fun things that him and his brother did that were not so fun for everybody else.
Oh, God.
There was a husband and wife who were literally just late in paying their debts, right?
Oh, God. He shot up their whole fucking house.
Close.
Oh, God.
So Frank and Clarence broke into their house and then just started auctioning off the couple's belongings to pay the debt.
7 over here. 7 over here.
It's 5 in the morning.
7 over here. 9 over here. 10. 10.
Just like moving the bed out while they're like going down the stairs.
Yeah. While they're on
still
the bed.
In it. And they're just like, ah, what?
This is funny. Well, they're actually in one of the states just recently, a judge said that you can't put anybody in jail for not being able to pay like fines or anything like that. Just recently that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, debtors' prisons were around for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. So that's just recently that this is starting to happen, is people are saying it's actually against the Constitution for income-based fines, but still they've been doing it. And at this time, especially if you didn't pay your debts, you're going to jail. And then how are you going to pay your debts when you're in jail? Who knows? But they'll figure it out. Pretty much is just fucked if you're in jail for not being able to pay fines or debts.
You got one job while you're in here. You're going to take big rocks. You're going to make them into smaller rocks. And you're going to take those small rocks and make them into even smaller rocks.
Yeah. And then you're going to sell these rocks.
And then we're going to arrest you for not paying your taxes on selling of those
rocks. Yes. Where's our little kickback for this rock? This actually backfired on them, right? So the couple sued them and won.
I fucking hope so.
Yeah, they sued them and won. And so Frank and Clarence obviously are like, let's not go do this again. And they toned down their cronying a bit.
Yeah, public breaking and entering.
Yeah, literally. And they toned it down because they're like, we don't want this to happen again. Well, another thing, during his time as sheriff, he ended up shooting a man that, like, he was chasing. The man had supposedly stolen something, and he ended up shooting a man.
Stamps.
Could have been stamps. He was a stickler for the law.
Mm-hmm.
He basically said that a guy, obviously, tried to pull a gun. That doesn't sound familiar to you or anybody. A guy tried to pull a gun on him while he was chasing him down, and he shot him and killed him.
God damn it.
Doesn't sound familiar, does it?
Nope.
They ended up finding out in the little autopsy they did on the body that the bullet went through the back.
Oh, so he was running.
He was running away from him, and he shot and killed him. Well, he lost his bid for re-election as sheriff, obviously, because everyone was pissed that he shot this guy, because it was the first shooting by a cop of a person ever in this town.
Damn.
So it was big news.
In all fairness, the law which made it illegal to wash or scrub sinks in Baltimore had just gotten passed, and people were really heated
at
the time.
Yeah, and they were pissed because they had to clean all their sinks. It was a lot.
Yeah.
It was a lot.
It was a lot.
Well, I was a lot. After losing the election, he was accused bribing voters at the booth with alcohol.
That was tradition, though.
Yeah.
That was tradition at the time.
Him and his brother went to the voting booth.
You weren't supposed to get caught doing it.
Exactly. But, you know, if you have enemies, right? So if you have enemies at this time, any little thing was going to get you knocked off the booth.
Yeah.
Yeah. He also ran for circuit court clerk for Howard County and lost that as well.
For circuit city clerk.
Circuit city clerk.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, rest in peace. R.I.P. Circuit City. Well, when he was giving out alcohol, it was with no strings attached. Wink, wink. As they were, like, walking into the voting booth. And honestly, if someone gave me alcohol, I was walking to the voting booth, I'd be like, I'm probably voting for you. Wink, wink.
Well, I mean, that was the very first election in this country. Like, it was a party day. Everybody's getting shit-faced. They were voting 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. Like, This is tradition.
Yeah, for sure. That's what the election cycle is about. Well, Frank was obviously gaining a really, really bad reputation across the state. He wasn't doing well by the people that he was supposed to protect and serve, so he had to settle himself down. I just still think about the South Park police thing on the side of their cars. It's like to annoy and something like that.
Yeah.
Is kind of what he was doing. So Frank wasn't succeeding in anything he did, right? And clearly he's not doing great in life at this time. So what do you do when you get when that happens?
Go back to daddy and ask for another job?
You get married.
Oh, yes.
Oh, you get married. It was noted that when they were walking down the aisle, she kept him so close and was holding his biceps so they didn't run away at the wedding. Because he was like, I don't want this. He's like leaving. He got married in 1897, so it was like he was just sitting there. And the authors go into how he hated like pomp and circumstance, so like he didn't want anything. Obviously, it kind of tells. And so she like stripped down the wedding. There wasn't that many people at the wedding, and you know she was very like beautiful, and she wanted to like really like dress things up. She wanted to have like big pomp and circumstance.
It was a wedding.
It was a wedding, right? It was
yeah.
their wedding.
Yeah.
And he was just like, I don't want that. I don't want to do any of that. I just want to be here, whatever.
Yeah, but he didn't even want to get married though. So.
Exactly. So just to get him to get married, she like stripped everything down. She didn't wear white.
Whoa.
Which was like a really crazy thing. She wore like a violet colored dress.
Ooh.
And the only thing white she wore was her gloves. And they're like beautiful satin lace.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, they're rich. His dad's rich. Her family is very rich as well. So it's like they kind of were just like trying to close it down a little bit. But she wanted like these crazy things.
We need 16 elephants.
I want you to ride in on an elephant. I'm going to ride in on a horse.
Abraham Lincoln's skull is going to officiate.
Yeah.
Hold on. Where'd the other pieces go?
Oh. So he married a woman named Margaret Galena on December 16th, 1897. And after they returned from their honeymoon, right, Frank learned that one of his best friends and employees was sentenced to jail and to death for a murder of his friend's rival.
So he went to go protect his friend.
His friend's name.
So then he could kill him. Yeah.
Wait, is that what happens?
This is just like circular. The man's name.
Are you fucking kidding me? He goes to protect his friend so that he can get killed by the state.
It does end a little differently this time.
Frank, couldn't you be spending this time looking into all this evidence I gave you that I'm actually innocent? What? No, the law's been carried out.
It's already happened. Joseph. The man's name was Joseph America. Literally his name. Joseph America.
They killed America.
I think I'm changing my last name, by the way. I am now going to be known as Joseph America.
Joseph Francis Gottlieb America.
Yes. Yes. That is my new name. So Joseph America apparently had a beef with his rival named Isaiah Nelson because Isaiah Nelson basically stole his wife from him.
That'll do it.
Yep. And this was widely known amongst the community, right?
Frank just couldn't understand. He's like, wait, you want her?
You want a wife?
Honeymoon. Well, more like money moon, if you ask me.
And Frank was obviously noted in the story and in life as like, he was notoriously penny pinching. He did not spend money and he did not like spending money. Mm. So
unless it was on his appearance or his well-being or his looks. Or on alcohol for bribery.
Well, he used other people's money for alcohol for bribery.
True.
Yeah, true. He used his backers.
I think to clarify, you're penny pinching. you mean like he was pinching other people's pennies out of their pockets as they walked by.
Exactly.
Gotcha, gotcha.
Yes, he was robbing them. Well, yeah, right.
Okay.
Well, while America was in jail, I wanted to say it like that. Frank visited him and brought him home-cooked food and blankets.
While America was on death row.
Death row. Frank visited him and brought him home-cooked food and blankets to keep him warm, right? So he's being a good friend. He helped him. Mm-hmm. Did more for him, obviously, his friend than the other guy. But he also, one of the things he didn't do before is he started lobbying the governor and state to stop the death verdict, right?
Wait a second. I know these people.
Yeah, I remember these people.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. And on June 17th, 1898, he met with the governor, and he got the capital punishment verdict overturned.
Bam. Just like that.
Yeah, just like that.
Just like that.
Happens with nepotism, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And Joseph America was...
And on July 4th, Joseph America was free.
It was so close. It was so close. Yep. He lived out the rest of his days in a penitentiary,
So he was still locked up, but...
He was set to live out the rest of his days in a penitentiary. Oh. Because even after that, Frank continued to lobby the governor. And 12 years later, America was pardoned of his crime and got out of the jail at 55 years old.
America pardoned America for its crimes.
And was free to live. Well... With no prospects for his future, obviously, Frank was at a crossroads. He had lost a bunch of elections. He kind of wasn't doing well in life, but he just got married, and obviously he's still rich, so he's just bad at his own life. Everybody else around him's doing great. He's doing bad. He couldn't get elected at offices.
He doesn't have to try so hard.
Yeah, he's trying very hard, though.
He doesn't need
he's
to,
trying.
Though.
I know, and that's the hard thing, is like, he's trying very hard, but he just is not very good at some of these things, right?
He's not good at anything.
He's not accentuating his own talents, right? Because he's meticulous. And that's one thing that he is a good thing in some ways and will come into his later job. So, well, obviously, just like a trust fund baby, his dad comes in to save the day again. He was pushed to get out of the house and get a job.
He was still living at home?
And I know he was already out of the house and had a few jobs. He was out of the house.
Okay.
But it was just fun to say that line for me.
Gotcha.
You know, you millennials and you're staying at home and not getting a job. Nah. You know the lines. Well, if it wasn't so expensive, we would be able to afford houses and have good paying jobs. Back in my day, we had 4 to 5 kids in a house and didn't have to spend money on coffee every day with your $5 lattes. Hey. That one hits close to home. My $7 to $8 lattes fuel me to write scripts for this podcast. So yeah. I want to thank Battle Cat Coffee and Philo Coffee for fueling this episode. This episode brought to you by Battle Cat Coffee. Don't battle your computer. Come here and battle a cat. Thank you, Battle Cat, actually, for helping me get this done. Well, anyways, his dad got him a job as a U.S. Post Office inspector, which is going to be where he's going for the rest of his life.
So his dad got him a job in one of the most powerful positions available.
Literally. With no resume. Like, his resume is shit right now.
Oh, yeah, no.
So, but his dad did, it's noted in the story, his dad literally wrote his son's resume to accentuate his strengths just so that he could get the job.
Who hasn't done that, though?
It's true. It's true. Mm-hmm. But when you're fired and lose every job you have... It's very hard to make that work. But again, nepotism baby right here. So, well, on March 7th, 1899, he was sworn in as the 156th Post Office Inspector.
I picture a bunch of people surrounding somebody being like, fuck you, you piece of shit, man. Fuck you, asshole. Fucking dirt wipe. What's a dirt wipe? Fuck you. I'm just like being sweared.
Yeah, just yelling at him. Yeah. Swearing at him. Well, it was time for him to leave his comfort and spread his wings, so to speak. Because he never left his hometown. Like, he was born in this town, and he has never left. So, I mean, it's not that different back in the day, right? But he needs to leave to get to do better things.
Fully qualified for a job that involves...
A lot.
Knowing the lay of the land and locations and traveling.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, he was sent down to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Not too far from us. To be the post office inspector there. It was a super superb job. His dad got him the job, basically. His dad used all of his political favors just to get the job because the pay was hefty and he was going to be super important in this time because it was the southern headquarters for the Post Office Inspection Service. So he's like right in the place where he can move. You know, he could rise up through the ranks and he can maybe get a better job up north because he actually did not like the area. He was in the South. He hated the South at this time.
Fair.
He was a Republican. He hated all the Southern Democrats. And just to go back and forth, he was still very political.
Yeah.
And as a post office inspector, you are told you cannot be political. You are neutral. You cannot run for offices at this time. You can't do anything at this job because you're supposed to be in the middle, you know, because otherwise you'd start having them holding back letters from anything like that. So it's kind of.
Yeah.
You have to be neutral in this whole time. So instead of living there, right, moving his family down there, he literally would just commute 20 hours by train back to his family on weekends. He was like, I don't want to live here. I'm just going to go 20 hours by train. And he sent, like I told about penny pinching earlier, he sent all of his money back. Like he did not keep anything. The good thing about being a postal office inspector is that everything you do can be paid for by the government. He could be working 24 hours on that time. He just expensed it. But the only thing that he really hated was that at the end of every day, you have to account for every hour, every cent you spend, and you have to write it down, give it to your boss, and they okay that, okay, this has all happened. This is what you've done for the day.
An expense report.
Yeah, an expense report. This is a very detail-oriented job. He loved that because he's meticulous, but he hated having to explain to someone why he was doing what he was doing, right?
So it says here you were in the outhouse for 9.5 hours. You got time to sit. You got time to shit. That's what I always say. Sorry.
It's true. Well, while he was shitting, he studied old cases and took gun safety classes. Not that part while he was shitting, but he did that after he finished.
Something he should have done as sheriff, but yeah.
Yeah, something because he never did that. He also took defensive shooting classes because I do want to say that he actually was very, he had a lot of PTSD from shooting that guy, which he shot him in the back, so he shouldn't have done that, but he really didn't want to. He thought about it afterwards. He had crisis of consciousness and was like, I don't want to shoot anybody anymore. I don't want to do this. I did not want to do that.
Yeah.
So he wanted to be the best at what he did. So he studied and he's very studious. Well, even though he was a sheriff, he literally had no experience in actually investigating crimes, right? Yeah. So he just enforced laws. He didn't investigate crimes. So he was given, like, you know, he was new. So he was given very small-time crimes, such as contractors continuously painting mailboxes and then expensing the government and getting kickbacks from the government for painting those mailboxes. And this is just the smallest of things, you know, $20 here, like $5 here, $15 here. And he was really just like, man, this fucking sucks. It's like I don't want to do this.
Some Huckleberry Finn deviance going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as he was doing this, he was getting the itch to go back into politics because he just loved politics. And it's hard to part from your own passion, right? So he just kept wanting to go back to politics. And this is one of the parts me and Gil talked about earlier. In August of 1899, his brother was running for Frank's old position on the Howard County Central Committee, right? So
in Maryland.
In Maryland. So Frank decided he would leave his post and go directly back to help his brother run for office without a word to his boss or anybody in his where he worked. He took the train back to Maryland and started campaigning for his brother, which is actually, like we just said, literally a big no-no to not do. He's not supposed to do that.
So he's skipping work to go basically go against what he's allowed to do. Which,
yes.
You can respect that in some ways, but a little bit. I mean,
I guess if he was doing
this in Chattanooga, it'd be more fucked up.
Oh, yeah. Well, he went another place, but still, the word spreads, right? Literally a day later on August 10th, 1899, the chief post office inspector in Washington, D.C. sent a letter to Frank saying, return to your post in Chattanooga. Literally, that's all the letter said.
Damn.
Yeah, it's pretty much There's no if, ands, or buts. On a just stamp. Return.
It was just a stamp.
It was written just on the stamp, yeah. It was a huge stamp on the no postage.
Really tiny stamp.
Yeah. Well, Frank was pissed, and he's like, why are you sending me this? I don't give a fuck. And he decided to ignore the letter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not delivering. It's not my job. He decided to ignore the letter for at least a day.
Mm-hmm.
Once Frank's father heard of this,
oh shit,
he was like, what are you doing? I got you this job. I literally begged for you to get this job. You have to go back to Chattanooga. But it was too late.
Uh-oh.
Frank decided to go back the day after that. Mm-hmm. Literally, as he was on his way back, his boss was writing that termination letter for him.
Damn.
And as soon as he got back, they gave him the termination letter. To add to this failure, his brother also lost the election.
I'm developing a very in-depth, how do I put this? Developing a bias of how I'm viewing this entire family. But yeah.
I know. It's just so bad. It's so bad. Well, Frank now running out of money, and his wife, who also loved to spend money traveling and buying expensive things, Frank ran out of options. I mean, he did what he's always done.
Went to his dad.
He went back to his dad. Yep. And his dad again helped him out. This time, he went into the postal records, the official record book of the inspectors, and he removed the word removed under his name, and he replaced it by reinstated. Literally, it was said in the book that they crossed out the word removed and just replaced the word underneath as reinstated. So they just reassigned him. It was the funniest thing that I've seen, that like they did, that this has happened in this, because like really that's all it took. Well,
got nothing to say on that.
Okay, I got nothing. Yeah. Well, he was reassigned basically, and the only problem is he did take a big pay cut, which was still not even that much comparatively. He was still making a lot of money.
Oh no, he's not able to afford traveling 22 hours every other day on a train. However, is he going to live?
Right. This time, he was sent out to Cincinnati, Ohio. Frank started out investigating much bigger cases this time, so it was honestly more like a promotion for him. Because, like, Chattanooga, you know, he was the young guy. They were just like, you're not getting anything, getting stupid cases. In Cincinnati, he gets there, and they're like, here's big cases. These are things that are going to make your name.
Somebody repainted the entire post office.
Yeah, the whole post office is painted.
God damn it.
He was doing internal investigations of postal workers and much bigger amounts of money, right? So most of the time they were investigating internal things because there's a lot of corruption in the postal service at this time. And a lot of it went all the way up to the Senate and the Congress. Frank was given a lot of leeway to conduct his investigations and a lot of money to keep going, so which he always loved to go undercover. His favorite thing was to go undercover in these cases.
Frank, when I invited you to this 10 a.m. meeting at the post office, thought it was assumed that this was just a staff meeting. You didn't have to go under. I'm not Frank. I'm Francois, the new French immigrant here to open up a bakery.
Frank, we know it's you, Frank.
You're just holding up a finger to your nose. You are not
we know it's
Francois
you, Frank.
From France. Oh!
God. Well, exactly. That's the one of the biggest things he loved to do. Mm-hmm. On a specific case, he took his 4-year-old son onto a train to catch somebody that was stealing large pouches of money, right?
Here, hold this gun.
He just wanted to look like a normal father on the train, right? And literally,
his son just wanted a normal father, too.
Yes. Eddie didn't get it. Quick, I'm Francois. Call me Francois, kid. Well, as soon as the robber came onto the train for the destination, he looked at Frank and was like, you're the cop. You're the cop trying to catch me. And he did ended up busting him, but the guy tried to get away, but he caught him.
How did he recognize me in my Texas Ranger badge?
Yeah, right. I'm not even in costume.
Should have been clear. I'm not from here.
Yeah. But he still caught the guy and, you know, obviously put him in jail. But he just, it, the undercover stuff was kind of blown out of proportion.
What was this guy? What was this guy being charged with or like being chased for?
He was stealing pouches on U.S. Postal trains, big, large pouches of money on U.S. Postal Service trains.
Oh, okay.
And,
gotcha.
Yeah. So, yeah, they were mixed with, you know, at this time, because they were like putting everything together.
Yeah.
They were mixed with people on the train and regular mail. So he was just, they knew where the guy was. They knew what he was doing. It wasn't a big operation, but the guy kept getting away with it.
Yeah, you can't hide from the Postal Service. That's the thing.
Literally. Literally, you can't.
They have your address.
I want you to everyone to know this now. Like, you cannot hide from the Postal Service. Yeah. They know you. Well, in the fall of 1902, Frank was put on the biggest assignment to date, right? So he was like, sweet.
Somebody painted the governor's house.
Yes. The biggest painting job to date.
I'm going to need all my kids for this one.
He had two at the time, so he could have used both.
We're going on a picnic. Yes, a picnic.
Yes.
Hold this gun.
Hold this gun. Here, you hold my gun, you hold my knife. Well, he went to investigate the Brant Dent Automatic Cashier Company, right? So at this time, yeah, it's a mouthful.
So this is like an early like cash register?
Mm-hmm. Automatic cashier.
Gotcha, gotcha. Okay.
He ended up busting the company and a bunch of postmasters.
Oh.
Because, right, this is one of the big things that happened, is that the company was selling these cashiers to the Postal Service, right? And they're getting, obviously, getting kickbacks for it. Like, the Senate was getting kickbacks. I think it was, like, something like $123,000 worth of cashiers.
That's, like, $40 billion back then. That, not really, but it's a lot of fucking money, yeah.
It's a lot of money, yeah. The senator was found out that he got a $12,000 kickback for selling these things. And literally, the reason they found that this happened was because he went into a, Frank went in into a, into a postal service, like one of the small out-of-the-way ones, and a post office, and saw like 30 cash registers just sitting there. Just like dusty. And he's like, what are those for? And they're like, well, they don't really work that well, and they would just sent to us. And he's like, that doesn't sound right. So he went to a few other ones, and he saw 20, 30 more. And he's like, there's something going on here. So he started researching into it and then told his boss. His boss was like, okay, like, look into it, find out.
Yeah.
Went to the senator, found out eventually, went to the company, right? So he went to the company and was like, huh, asked the boss, asked the president, and the president of the company was like, yeah, they don't really work, but we sold them anyways. It has to be known that Frank is also a hothead. So he's
really,
he gets pissed very easily. Yeah,
really,
he gets pissed really easily. So when he confronted the owner, and the owner said, these don't work,
slammed his face into a cash register, ching, like just...
And that's the punchline. He punched him in the face. He punched the owner in the face, and the guy like came back, started like punching him. And so
beat the fucking shit out of him.
Yeah. Well, Frank, they got separated. So they were separated, and like both of them came in with bruises, obviously.
You're lucky this cash register's in my way.
This broken cash register.
Strangling him with receipt tape. Sorry.
Yeah. As Frank was like walking away, like, and he's been pulled away pretty much.
Yeah.
He had like cuts, bruises on his face, and he turned around with a really wide smirk and smiled at the guy. Smiled at the president. Because he was like, I love this. You know, this was because, you know, when he was younger, he was a fighter.
He's got that high.
Right?
Yeah.
He's got that high. So he's like, I love this thing, right? After about a couple months, he ended up serving 50 indictments of corruption inside the U.S. Post Office. And he was like, hell yeah, with that same smirk.
One punch at a time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was doing great things, actually, in Cincinnati. So, like, he started finding his little niche, right? I mean, besides, you know, punching the guy, which you're not really supposed to do.
I'm sorry, but finding crime in Cincinnati is not that
hard. Truth. Truth. And he would find a lot more.
I've spent so much time there. I've driven through there a million times. Every hour on the hour, there are gunshots anywhere in that fucking city, and it's been like that my whole life.
Yes.
It is not hard. The fact that he found this obscure-ass cash register crime, when there's probably like literally like Bonnie and Clyde running around in the background, like, you know, just like...
Oh yeah, true. But I mean, it was a big thing because it went all the way up to the senator, you know, and he didn't actually get to, he didn't actually get the senator, he didn't actually get to like indict the senator. He did end the guy's political career though.
Oh shit.
Because he still tied it to him and used people in the papers to get him not reelected.
Gotcha.
Ruined the guy's political career, never was reelected again. So he did in a way get the senator out for doing that, but he didn't get to indict him, which is what he really wanted, you know, because he's a stickler for the law. So Republican Party connections to get him out of there.
Yeah.
Well, so eventually, because he was doing so well, he ended up getting moved to Columbus, Ohio in 1907, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's to be said that he was generally not a great person outside of his post office job. And his boss freaking hated him in Cincinnati. His boss was like, okay, so take it like this, right? He's the hothead here, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of comparing you and me. He's the hothead, mm-hmm. which is you, and crazy going crazy. And then his boss was like really level-headed.
Yeah.
Just me. Very level-headed. His boss was like, why did you punch that guy? You didn't have to do that.
Yeah. Why are you bringing your kids every day to work and putting them in dangerous situations?
Yeah.
And then starting fights with random people.
Yeah. And he flipped out and he was like, because that's how I do things.
Solid.
Literally. And so the boss was like, well.
Can't argue with that.
Yeah. I mean, great comeback. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the boss was like, well, I don't really want you, you know, sullying the name of Cincinnati Postal Service, postal inspectors here. So he sent him to Columbus, which is like not super far away from Cincinnati, right?
A couple hours.
So in Columbus, it was where he would be thrown into his biggest investigation ever.
Somebody painted the city. I'm going to need to make more kids for this one.
It's time to go back to work. Honey, give me the ice for my hands. Well, on April 18th, 1908, in Bellefontaine, Ohio, a body was discovered. It was the body of Salvatore Sera, a fruit seller originally from Pittsburgh. He was shot to death on the floor of DeMar's Fruit Importers. The police brought Frank letters that were sent to Sera before he was murdered. And the first letter read something along the lines of,
"Hello there, new friend. We very much like to connect with you and discuss your donation of $2,000 to our hands so that you may live to see another day."
And the second letter that said,
"Not done what we asked, friend. You must pay us $2,000 or we will come for you. We will cut your heart out and you will die like a dog."
So that's the letters Frank was given on the death of Salvatore.
But why did the police bring him letters? Were they like also so scared of like the postal folks that they were just like, we're not allowed to open these, but you are? Like, why did they, what the fuck happened?
Well, a lot of it, they were investigating at first, right?
Yeah.
So they were looking into it and they decided like, hey, this is more of a postal service matter.
The only man that can solve this is Frank.
They're passing the buck. They're literally passing the letter.
Gotcha.
You know, they're like, we don't want to do this. And since they were letters, it's literally the post office inspector will look into this.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest thing is that they literally did, I'm not paid enough for this. And
nice.
Gave the money. Yeah, they're like, I'm not paid enough for this.
Nice.
And then handed the letters off to somebody else. Well, it's here that we're going to introduce our second protagonist of the story.
Oh?
And this guy is freaking awesome. I have to say, he is the coolest part of this story. He's not an asshole like Frank Coldfield. So he didn't get there by his dad. He did all the work himself. So we're going to rewind back to 1890, right? So about 14 years before where we were right now.
Parallel timeline.
Yeah, parallel timeline, yeah. Just to introduce this guy. In Pennsylvania, a 26-year-old man named Francis Demio, a dapper young Italian-American immigrant who worked for the Pinkerton Detective Agency, would make his mark. So we're going outside of the U.S. government now. And we've talked about the Pinkerton Agency before. We all have our thoughts about the Pinkerton Agency. They were not that great, but they were the premier private detective group. They had a relentless tenacity to track down leads and go after fugitives, and they were one of the highest paid private groups in this time. Though that was fruitful, right? And they made money doing that. The biggest money that they made was siding with businesses against unions, basically roughing up union leaders and organizers until they saw the light.
At the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, they were not a very good agency, but they were the only ones that were actively really investigating really big murders. Because remember when we talked about in the Benders that the only people that were coming in, the Pinkerton agency, everyone was afraid of them to come in. Everyone was afraid because they were obviously going to rough up some people, going to do some not very good things.
Yeah, they're high profile mercenaries.
Well, the only people that ended up founding in the Benders, remember, was his brother. He was the one that did all the work to find him.
True.
And found out that it was them. But anyways, Francis Demio was one of the only Italian-American agents at the time. He actually was the only Italian-American agent.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was recruited by them for a very special task because they're like, hey, we don't have any have anybody to do the things now that because Italians, Sicilians at this time, different people at this time because about 20 years, 30 years before this, Italy wasn't even a country. They were just still a small bunch of kingdoms until about, I think, the late 1890s.
Also, this is at a time when Italians literally aren't considered white.
Yep.
All these good old boy racist organizations and shit like that, like, you read everything about, like, black folks and Asian folks and Italians. it's yep. right there with it. So this is their idea of being very progressive. Look at that. We're not all white. We have an Italian guy here.
They're looking ahead.
Yeah.
Well, in New Orleans, right, a crop of Sicilian criminals were popping up, right? So we're going to say Sicilians because that's actually where they were from. And Sicily was its kind of own little government around this time.
Yeah. Sicily is just the Florida of Italy. Everyone knows that.
I'm good with that connection, actually. I think they might agree.
We're going to get murdered before part two.
Yeah. Oh, true. That may be after part two. That might be when we get murdered.
Ugh.
Well, Demio was actually a master of disguise, right? And he became an expert undercover agent. Unlike Frank Oldfield, he was really good at being a master of disguise. He didn't just go, this is my, put a finger over his nose.
I got a mustache. No, I don't have a mustache. Where'd he go? Where'd he go?
Who is he?
Yep. He blended in with the crowd of other Italians. I can't even make them out. Where did they all look the same to me?
Honestly, that's probably actually
yeah, no
true.
Problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he ran down criminals extorting money from mining companies. He exposed Italian hitmen and infiltrated gangs that raided mines. So he was doing a lot of work on people's...
So he was actually doing shit. Yeah.
Yeah, he was in the field, right?
Mm-hmm.
He could appear to be, this is what they described in the book, right? So
he could be a rich man, a poor man, a tall man, a short man. He could be anything.
This is just the racist thought at the time. He could be anything. He could appear to be from northern Italy or the islands of Sicily or even Spain. Okay, so like I want to make the distinction here. So Italians at that time differentiated people from Sicily.
100%, yeah.
And they differentiated, it's like talking to somebody from Georgia and then talking to somebody from Milwaukee, you can tell their accents are different, right? It's the same idea. And so he was able to hide, and like his accent was good in either side. Like he can learn languages quick.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was just one of those people, who's like a jack of all trades. He can learn quickly.
Now I'm a waiter. Now I'm a bowl of spaghetti. Now I'm a waiter again.
Yeah.
Now I'm a bottle of wine.
Yeah. Well, it was said that he could swing a pickaxe just like a coal miner. He could learn that within a day. So he could, I mean, obviously, because he was going in these mines, he was looking for people that were stealing money. He could steer a ship into port and dock it with the best of them. He was pretty good at everything, just very quickly. He was kind of like James Bond, mm-hmm. who just literally happens to be very good at everything he does randomly, even True. Though he's never done it. And honestly, everybody knows a person that literally can pick up something and just be like, good.
All right, Gil doesn't, apparently.
I don't know anybody. Like,
okay. Well,
because I am that person to everybody else.
You are that person if you know this. Well,
where'd it go?
Where did Gil go? He just put his finger over his mouth, his mustache. Where did he go? Well, he was so good at his job that he was never blown his cover. Nobody blew his cover.
They couldn't
hide. Yeah. He escaped any types of pitchers. He was never associated with anything. So, there'd be pictures, random pictures taken of stuff, of sometimes outings for even the work. And what was noted was that he was markedly average from his height to how his face looked.
Mm.
So, like, he just didn't have any distinguishing features.
Yep.
The only thing that was noted that his features were distinguished was his hair.
A flaming eagle tattoo on his face.
What? He was very American, and a big American flag over his heart. It was noted his hair was black like obsidian, which gave him the awesome nickname of the Raven.
Oh, shit. Damn.
Yeah. Is such a cool nickname for this guy, right? And he was one of the best out there. And he was one of one.
He is everything that Frank Oldfield daydreamed about being, but was too afraid to actually have the experiences to become.
Exactly. And so, like, you know, you want to look at it like this. You have Frank Oldfield, meticulous, great at doing these, like, little detailed things, and he's also white and rich and affluent.
And he totally breaks the law anytime that it's a convenience to him and has only ever failed upwards.
yeah, literally. And then you have this guy who's an Italian-American at the time who's, like, basically doing all the grunt work. He's infiltrating people. So in 1890, he was set on a path to infiltrate the mafia in New Orleans, right? So infiltrate, you know, it's before it's called the mafia, but we're just going to say it's mafia-like at this time because it's the beginnings of it. It's how it starts being built.
Mafia light.
Yeah, mafia light, yep. And so he was told to let his beard grow a little so that it can look more like a Sicilian brigand, right? So basically, they're like, you know, you need to look a little more scruff.
It's going to need to be at least a quarter of an inch.
Yeah. Right, I think he got a little mustache, too. A real mustache, not a finger mustache, yeah. Well, New Orleans, there was a murder of a police chief named David Hennessy, right? So on October 13th, 1890, as Hennessy walked to his house from work...
He was hit by a trolley?
He fell out of the trolley.
It was the same trolley who had reached out to Frank Oldfield's dad and was like, hey, I need a new job. And they transferred the trolley to New Orleans.
The killer trolley. Well, as Hennessy was walking to his house from work, a teenage boy stepped out of the darkness and walked beside the chief. So just this little boy, it's just like this, you know, little boy in general sense, teenage boy, was walking right beside him and just... out of nowhere, shotguns started firing at the chief, and the chief was shot, right? So he actually was able to chase the attackers for a block or two, right? Because he's shot, he's still trying to get to the attackers, he's the police chief. So he eventually fell over, right? And just, like, went into a coma and then died three days later in the hospital. The only thing that the chief said before he died was Italians had shot him. It used a different word that I don't want to say here, but he said Italian, but I'm saying Italians had shot him.
I immediately picture Chief Hennessy just like every other day he stubs his toe. Goddamn Italian furniture.
Yeah, no, and that
burns his mouth. Goddamn Italian bread.
He literally, yeah, that was him. It was New Orleans at this time. It wasn't very accepting. It wasn't accepting to anybody of non-whites, right? So police afterwards went out to the ghettos, the Italian ghettos, and arrested more than a dozen Italian-Americans.
Gotta be one of them.
It's pretty bad. Well, they didn't really have any evidence against any of the men. And if anything went to trial, they'd literally all go back out on the street, right? Witnesses were bribed and threatened, and the gang in jail was openly boasting about being back to their old ways in no time. So basically, they were part of a gang. They kind of were part of the gang in the mafia, basically, in New Orleans at this time. And so the people outside of jail, the bosses were bribing witnesses. So they couldn't get any evidence to go against these men.
Yeah.
So here's where the plan starts. Demio would go to a small town just outside of New Orleans and pay for things with counterfeit money, right? So it's a small thing, but still could put him in jail for a long time at this point. So the Pinkerton agency was like, okay, time for you to go. We're going to send you down there with all this counterfeit money. There was only six people, right, who knew of what's happening in this. So basically they told him, and they gave him an out. They were like, hey, if you don't want it, this is dangerous. Like, you could be killed in jail. We can't help you, you know? Like, we can't get you out of there. And so he was like, I'll do it, whatever.
Yeah. I'm the fucking Raven.
This dude's just like, I'm all in. Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, no, seriously, if you do not want to do this, we can send you somewhere else.
No, but like, seriously, you might die.
Yeah, you might die. We cannot help you.
We can't even afford to send you there. That's why we printed off all this money.
Yeah. And like, he's just like, nah, fucking, let's go. Let's do this shit. You know, he's like all in for this. This guy's awesome.
Yeah.
So he went to a small town just outside of New Orleans, right? And he's just like, gets to a hotel and he pays for a nice room with the counterfeit money. Then he goes into town and he's like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to buy all this stuff and buy all this good food. So he lives it up a little bit, right? He's like living it up in this town because he's like, why not? I have all this counterfeit money. Nobody knows.
Yeah.
So he also at this time, because he wanted to appear rich, he had like a nice suit, you know, full of counterfeit money that was actually sewn in. So they sewn in the money underneath his suit too.
Classic.
So like, obviously he can, it's easier to carry around with him. He's not just carrying this big duffel bag.
God, he had to be sweating so bad.
Oh God, and especially near New Orleans. So on January 3rd of 1891, in Louisiana, day went just as they contrived it. He was arrested by a man named Agent Azariald Wild.
Fuck yeah.
Which is such a cool name, right? At the hotel, Agent Wild caught up to him, right? And this, you know, he was one of the six that knew about the plan. So obviously, he put on this terrific show of ripping open his jacket and being like, ha ha, did you see this? I've got you now. This whole like movie scene of the coat ripping it open.
Just fucking sold it. Yeah.
Yeah, sold it. And like the hotel, the lady who was running the hotel was like, oh my God, and fainted and everything because she was like, they ran it out of the money. And that was part of the whole thing. And then it was funny because later they talked to him. They interviewed Demio and asked him about it. And he was like, Agent Wild put on a terrific show. You know, it was like talking about like how it was just so overblown and everyone's kind of like, okay.
I'm walking towards the dinner table now. I see a suspect. Hey, Captain, look over here. I see someone.
Yeah. It was bad.
Yeah.
You know, so, well, the whole town came out, right? Because he went downtown and bought everything with all this counterfeit money. When they found out that he did this, the whole town came out to the train platform. And was like sitting there like, we're going to kill you. We're going to do this. We're going to do that, you know? And so luckily, one of the Pinkerton agent like heads was there. And also the guy Wild that was putting him on the train, protecting him like, we got him. No, don't worry about it. We're sending him down to jail.
Yeah.
So on January 5th, Demio was thrown into a dank cell block with a wooden bucket, which the guards also called the ice cream freezer. You know, they have to have little funny things to keep their job interesting, right? Well, he was right next to the cells of the Sicilians who were accused of killing the sheriff. Worked out perfectly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now it was all up to Demio to make sure that he wasn't suspected of being an informant, because the prisoners thought weirdly of this man in a nice suit, because they didn't even take his clothes off. They just sent him in there with the suit. And one of the guards, they gave out some information that a detective was most likely trying to infiltrate the prison to get some information. So the guards were in on all this too, right?
Yeah.
And they're telling the Sicilian prisoners, I think that there's a detective coming in here. And for some reason, nobody knows how they knew. There's no interest in how that they got this information, but they passed it along to the prisoners. Well, the prisoners start thinking like, man, I think that this guy is like, this guy looks like an informant, right? He's probably somebody sent in here, which is obviously he's the new guy in a suit coming into the jail. So obviously, immediately, Demio picked out his target on who he would probably get to give him the information. He picked out a smaller man named Manuel Polizzi. Manuel was harassed by the other Sicilians and looked nervous. He called him the perfect stool pigeon. Well, over time, Demio picked his brain and was friendly, but not too friendly to Manuel. The other Sicilians would try to share bread with Manuel and send wine to his cell to the amazing counterfeiter Demio, which I want to explain first of why that happened. So Demio was sitting in his prison cell, and one of the guards came up and just threw a newspaper and was like, hey, read about yourself, right? Right before he could, the prison doors were next to each other. The cells didn't have walls, right? They had just like bars. So before he could get the paper, one of the other Sicilians picked up the paper and started reading it and saw Demio's face in it. Read basically,
a famous counterfeiter from Italy was being hounded from Chicago all the way down to New Orleans by police.
So basically, if they're like, oh shit, this guy might actually be a real counterfeiter.
Mm-hmm.
This guy would do well with us, right? So they're thinking like, this guy is real. He's the real deal. Like, he's not a detective anymore. So they started sending him wine. They were just trying to like get cozy up to Demio, you know, get kind of, oh yeah, maybe when we get out, you can like work with us. Well, Demio's just basically like, I don't want to talk to you. didn't even talk to these guys. It was just basically giving them all the cold shoulder. Well, what he did with Polizzi, every time they got sent wine and food, hey, those guys are trying to kill you. Those guys are poisoning your wine. They're poisoning that bread. He'd like open the bottle of wine and be like, there's poison in there. And he basically was pushing those two against each other, like all the Sicilians against Manuel Polizzo. And so,
yeah,
eventually, Polizzo gave up all the information of the Hennessy murder, right? Basically trusted Demio, and he was basically giving him the easiest way out. He's like, hey, just tell me what happened. Tell me all the information of what's going on. And he did. Well, Demio committed everything that he was told by Polizzi to memory and then wrote a detailed note that was given to a person who was getting his notes out to the Pinkertons, right? So at this time, he had a lawyer who was coming to visit him every week, and he would get out a note to them saying, here's what I've learned, here's what's coming out. So he wrote a huge detailed note for everything. And when asked, when the other prisoners asked Demio why a lawyer was coming to visit him, he's just like, oh, I got a dame on the outside that I'm writing to. And they were like, okay. They just stopped asking questions.
Nice.
And he was like, okay, cool. That was easy. Yeah. Well, a few days after this last note was delivered, Demio was released from prison, right? So he had everything he needed.
How the hell did he get released from prison? I mean, he was in with literally a suit full of counterfeit bills and like so many illegal transactions around the area.
They paid his bond. The Pinkertons came in and paid his bond and got him released from prison.
With counterfeits.
Yeah, with counterfeits. You had to get him out. Well, they paid his bond to get him out. And
gotcha.
Because the other guards didn't know. Nobody knows. There was only six people that knew at this time.
Yeah.
And even the lawyer that was taking the notes didn't know what was happening. He just thought they were just normal. Because the less people that know, the better, you know? Because obviously somebody could be bribed. He could be killed.
Yeah.
So when Polizzi was ready to spill the beans in court on February 16th, indictments were handed out for the prisoners. When they went to trial, the gang placed and bribed the jury. So they basically placed everybody that they knew, friends they knew, in there. And then the rest of the jury, they bribed, right?
Yeah.
Six of them were found not guilty. So this is out of nine of them. Six of them were found not guilty, and the three others were deadlocked. Even though some of the people were bribed, they still voted to put these guys in jail. So nobody knows what happened to those jury members afterwards, but they probably weren't doing too well. So all of them were going to walk away scot-free, right? So they're getting out of jail. Nothing was going to happen to them. Well, people breaking into jail and murdering the prisoners was not just a thing that happened in Maryland. It happened everywhere. 2 days after the trial, before they got out of jail, a rampageous mob marched into the jail with axes to break the door. And with no policemen in sight, they took them out, hung them, and then shot their bodies with shotguns.
God damn it.
You can't get away from it, right? So no. Lynching was happening everywhere, right?
We've never been a patient country.
No, no. And what's funny is like these were just a bunch of businessmen and people that were dealing with a lot of these Italian gangs. So they were getting, because there's big crackdowns, there's big people saying, hey, you're going to pay us for security for us not to kill you, you know? And that was the whole part of it. Just like the cartels are doing now in Mexico. You're going to pay us for security, just like the mobs are doing everywhere. We're doing everywhere at this time, just like Ying Sao did in China at that time. So it happened everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, because of all this and because of all the Italian gangs in there, it started a huge crackdown on Italian Americans in New Orleans. Basically, anyone who looked Mediterranean was getting thrown in jail. And in the chaos, Demio, as he was trying to leave town, was rounded up and arrested.
Damn, they got the Raven.
He got charged with vagrancy. He's like, I don't live here, but...
I was walking at 1 p.m. on a Tuesday to the train station.
Literally, actually. But this time they let him off with the stern warning, which was a weird thing. And as he made his way to go to the train to get out of town, he was arrested again. He's just like, God, I can't get out of town. I'm trying to leave. I'm trying to get out of here.
Where the fuck is that trolley that they told me about? I need its help.
I need that killer trolley. Well, this time the judge was pissed because he saw this same repeat offender.
I just saw you.
Yeah, yeah, literally. And he wanted to jail him. Luckily, the Pinkertons were still in town. So they came and bargained with the judge to take Demio off their hands. They said he was wanted in another town for way more serious crimes. They couldn't spill the beans that he was undercover because there was so little people that knew about it.
Yeah.
So they took him to the train and were like, get the fuck out of here. They were like, you should get going. This is really bad down here.
I've been trying to for weeks.
Yeah. He's like, thank God. Well, he got on the train, you know, headed out, and then he went on a honeymoon with his wife, who he literally just married a few months before.
And they went to New Orleans for their honeymoon.
I forgot. They went to some island somewhere. I forgot where it was, but it was a nice honeymoon for them. But what's funny is, like, he also couldn't tell his wife where he was going because, obviously, you know, he's part of an agency, you know, undercover.
Yeah.
And he had just gotten married a few months before, and they had brought this up to him. And he was like, damn, I guess, like, you know, this is going to make my career. Pretty much this made his career, you know, and helped him get to where he will be in the future. Well, these laws and crackdowns in New Orleans had a huge indirect effect on a lot of what would happen in the 1900s. Many Sicilians and Italians would move up north to Chicago, New York, Pittsburgh, and where our story leads next week, Cincinnati, Ohio. And that's where we'll pick up for part two with the introduction of the Black Hand Society.
I'm excited.
Me too. It's going to be fun. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week for part two.
Thank Bye. Y'all. Bye. They killed America.